Good evening, everyone. So, I've got a talk and lots of questions. So I'll see if I can weave the two together. Very interesting questions. One of which was actually on the topic of my talk. So I'll start with that question. One of the questions had to do with how much effort we put into, how do we know if we're over-efforting in our practice? And when Melody was lighting the candle right beside me, I heard the lighter, and what popped into my head was one of the Buddha's sayings that I used to always bring up, and I haven't brought it up for years, is, you know, practice like your hair's on fire. You'd be pretty determined if your hair was on fire. But it's also not a willful effort. It's more of a gentle, a wise effort that we bring to the practice, but an urgency. I think that's what he meant by the hair is on. It's an urgency. You want to get the fire out. So I'm going to start with just talking about the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the fourth noble truth. And I'm going to begin with a story. There's a story about a learned Tibetan scholar being asked about one of the most striking ways that Tibetans express the uniqueness of the human condition. Imagine, they say, that deep in the vast ocean there swims a great and ancient turtle who surfaces for air once every 100 years. Imagine further that floating somewhere in the ocean is a single ox yoke, carried here and there by random waves and currents. What are the chances that when the turtle surfaces, his head will happen to emerge precisely through the center of the ox yoke? That is how rare it is to be a human being. In the middle of the conversation, I pointed to the crowds of men and women rushing by in the street, and I gestured in a way to indicate not only them, but all the thousands and millions of people rushing around in the world. Tell me, Long Sang, I said, if it's so rare to be born a human being, how come there are so many people in the world? My friend slowed his pace and then stopped. He waited for a moment, taking in my question. I remember suddenly being able to hear, as though for the first time, the loud and frantic traffic all around us. He looked at me and very quietly replied, "How many human beings do you see?" So it's the understanding of that story is that most of us don't live as human beings. We live as what... in Buddhism, they call hungry ghosts, being, not really here with our being, but busy doing, kind of frantic. Hungry ghosts, starved for more time, more material possessions, always wanting more and more, and so we miss the present moment. And we miss the mystery and the beauty of being a human being. Another story. It's one of my favorite stories. A Canadian businessman was at the pier of a small coastal Mexican village when a small boat with just one fisherman docked. Inside the small boat were several large yellowfin tuna. The Canadian complimented the Mexican fisherman on the quality of his fish and asked how long it took to catch them. The Mexican fisherman replied, "Only a little while, senor." The Canadian then asked, "Why didn't you stay out longer and catch more fish?" The Mexican fisherman said he had enough to support his family's immediate needs. The Canadian businessman then asked, "But what do you do with the rest of your time?" The fisherman said, I sleep late, fish a little, play with my children, take a siesta with my wife Maria, stroll into the village each evening where I sip wine and play guitar with my amigos. I have a full and busy life, senor. The Canadian scoffed. I have a Harvard MBA and I could help you. You should spend more time fishing, and with the proceeds, buy a bigger boat. With the proceeds, an even bigger boat, you could buy several boats, and eventually you would have a fleet of fishing boats. Instead of selling your catch to a middleman, you could sell directly to the processor, eventually opening up your own cannery. You could control the product, processing, and distribution. You could leave this small coastal fishing village and move to Mexico City, even LA, and maybe New York City, where you could run an expanding enterprise. The Mexican fisherman asked, but senor, how long will this take? To the Canadian businessman replied, 10 to 15 years, maybe 20. But then what, senor? The Canadian businessman laughed and said, that's the best part. When the time is right, you could announce an initial public offering, sell your company's stock to the public, and become very rich. You could make millions. To which, then, millions, senor, then what, said the fisherman. To which the Canadian businessman replied, then you could retire, move to a small coastal fishing village where you could sleep a little, fish a little, play with your kids, take siestas with your wife, stroll to the village in the evenings where you could sip wine and play your guitar. Laugh every time I read. That's the samsara, sort of displayed quite humorously, but truthfully in many ways. I'm just kind of living for future moments and not in the present moment, and living as a hungry ghost. To kind of wove the two notions together. So with the Eightfold Path's quite astonishing and quite amazing. When you read it, it seems at first glance, it might seem rather simple. You know, three kind of meditation practice elements, wisdom elements, and some ethical elements as well. It makes sense. What's so amazing about it? What's amazing about it to me is it's the path that the Buddha laid out to recognize suffering, the origin of suffering, and the end of suffering, which is the path to liberation, to freedom, nirvana. Somebody asked a question about. So it's that so-called path, but it's also it also has the element that you're already free. You just don't see it. It's clouded by the egoic mind's wanting things to be other than they are. And this, what this Eightfold Path does is allow you to kind of live your life as if you're already free and incline your mind towards freedom. So not only is it living as if you're already free because you are, but also inclining the mind in that way so that it can be seen. So it's not a self-improvement project, although it can be, you know, we can make it that. Sometimes people come to this path thinking that it's going to improve me somehow. And, if I'll practice and then I'll attain and then I'll be fine. The problems will disappear. It's not that. It's not a belief system. So it's not a dogma that we adopt and kind of go around and convince other people to believe or, you know, maintain a against all odds kind of belief. It's something we cultivate and we practice with and we deepen with. We develop insights, insights arising with regards to what it means to do each of the practices and going deeper and deeper levels with the practices. So the eightfold path includes right understanding, right aspiration or intention. The first one is this right understanding, right view, and I'll talk about each of them. And it's probably first for I think it's first on purpose. Then you've got the sila or morality aspects, and this includes things like right speech, right action, right livelihood, and then you have the more the practice aspects, which include right or wise. You can use the word wise or right, right concentration, right mindfulness, and right effort. The word sama is what's translated as right or wise or perfect. It's inclining the mind in that way. So those are the aspects, and so we often start with the meditation practices, which are the last three: concentration, meditation, and effort. Effort being the kind of orientation that we bring to the practice. It's an interesting word, effort, because it's what it's pointing to is non-striving in the way that we apply this effort. But in the West, we tend to start with those practices. In the East, they start with sila. They start with the ethical teachings first. The very first teaching that the Buddha would give often was the teaching on generosity or dana. And then would offer other teachings around right speech and right action, the right livelihood. And I think the reason when teachers that you know, Burmese Sayadaws and so forth, that there's a story of Mahasi Sayadaw coming to the Insight Meditation Center and saw all the stuff about meditation, and his initial response was, well, where's the sila? Like, where are you teaching about the ethical foundations? And that was kind of a wake-up call, because we don't teach it a lot. Maybe there's an aversion because people are like, you know, is this more like Ten Commandments kind of stuff? Or, and it's not. It's really something to be aware of and practice and notice when right speech. Notice that there's an intention to have right to speak wisely, but if it doesn't happen, it's not like you then, you know, beat yourself up for it. It's noticing, oh, harsh speech arose in this situation. Look, this is how I feel, how the other person feels, and taking note of that, and then starting, you know, beginning again. I think the other thing that these sila or morality teachings allow is kind of a purification process, I guess. If you're harming people through speech and action and livelihood, then when you sit to meditate, guess what? It's going to come up. The story, you know, the regrets and stories about these events. So by practicing these, it's kind of smooths the path, the road for more stillness in our meditation as well. So there's that connection. In fact, all the elements of the Eightfold Path are connected in so many ways. So there was a question about waking up. Actually, there were quite a few on things like what's enlightenment and nirvana and waking up and so forth, which is not something I often talk about in talks. Like, go into great detail in talks, especially short retreats. We could do a whole retreat on, you know, the 8 stages of enlightenment with something, you know. Then we can sort of set up things that we want to attain, right? Like, I want to get to this stage and then this stage and this stage. And even the striving for enlightenment gets in the way of seeing. Because there's an eye there that wants something. It wants something different than what's already here. But if you can see it as not getting to something, but just kind of clearing, letting the clouds clear so that you just see what's already here. But I'll still talk about it. actually, the easier way I like to talk about it is, rather than what, you know, do, it's looking at ways that we fuel suffering. Because if you can, nirvana actually means to extinguish what fuels suffering. It's an extinguishing. It's not like a heaven, or it's not a place we go to, or it's not like our souls being absorbed into something. Nirvana is translated as to extinguish the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. To extinguish what fuels our ignorance, the opposite of wise understanding is ignorance. So here's how we fuel suffering: trying to control our experience. So we've talked about that in the group conferences, how letting go of this control can be difficult. Making demands of others is another way that we fuel suffering, and rejecting what is. Now, saying those three things, just pointed to about 3 questions in there. You know, what do we do with things like grief? How do we relate to grief? How do we relate to anticipation? Is that contrary to the Four Noble Truths, looking forward to something? I forget what the other one means. It's the enlightenment, anticipation, grief. Oh, attachment and detachment. Here's the other one. The past. Past hurts, trauma, and so on. How do we relate to that? And all three can be, four of those aspects can be addressed through these 3 ways that we fuel suffering. So let's take the most difficult one first, perhaps, the past. Wanting a different past fuels suffering. People are going to hear that and perhaps reject the statement. That's fine, just notice that that's what's arising. But wanting a different past, arguing with the past, fuels suffering. It doesn't mean we have to like what happened, right? It just means we don't argue, we don't reject or argue with that aspect of our past. Because after all, that past is what got you here, where you are today. if I looked at my past, at the different aspects that at the time I saw as, not wanting roles, right? I mean, at the time, I was trying to control, and my initial reaction was to not want. If I look back, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. I wouldn't be sitting here doing what I do without those past events. You guys wouldn't be, many of you might not be here doing this practice. So that past is what made you who you are now. So if we're rejecting that past, we're in a way rejecting who we are in this moment. So that's a difficult one, because there's trauma and there's hurt as part of, can be part of that past. So we're not arguing with the past or accepting the past. You're accepting the joyous aspect and the difficult aspects as well. Now, in terms of the anticipation of the future, I think it was with regards to a party. I love a good birthday party. And I'm looking forward to that birthday party. Is that contrary to Four Noble Truths? Because it's not in the present moment. We can have looking forward. I say that a lot. Can't wait to get together with so and so. I'm looking forward to seeing you. It's just and the thought brings joy that we're going to have an event, or we're going to see a beloved person, or of course we can build it up into something bigger than it maybe is, and then we can cause suffering if we like the chocolate cake story, right? Oh yeah, wait. But if it's held with a lightness and it's not clinging, there's not a clingy mind state, then it's not, it won't be fueling suffering. So it's like looking at the desire, or desire for a particular outcome. This has to be the best birthday party ever. Everybody has to have a good time. And so now, that aspect, so clinging to outcome. So we can get clingy in terms of the desire, and we can get clingy to the a particular outcome. But if we can let go of that, and just allow anticipation to be, then that's not contrary to the Four Noble Truths. Which I think you're basically saying, does it fuel suffering? Whoever asked that question. So look, I mean, I'm saying all these things, but again, don't believe me. Look and see. So if I have an event coming up, if I relate to it in this way, is there a contraction? Is there a tightness? Like, look at the body, go to the body and see what's arising. Or is there a joyous kind of lightness to it? So by the end of 3 months, I developed a relationship with the walk to the cake experience that was joyous. And I learned a lot just from that progression through the different ways that I was fueling suffering. So that's what you just look at your own experience. See if it's what's true for you. That's why we spend so much time on the body in this practice. We could probably spend more time in mindfulness-based stress reduction. It's like the first half of the course is the body scan. I always wondered why, and I think not always, but initially I wondered why, and I think it is because awareness of the body is so crucial to knowing our experience, knowing the emotional tenor of what we're experiencing, because emotions live in the body. You can you can get to know emotions by knowing what's arising in the body, and develop a relationship with particular emotions. Just go to the body. Develop a relationship with emotions. An emotion that was often arising some years ago was impatience. And actually, you know, I come from a proud lineage of impatient people. So I had a teacher, this is way back, not a recent teacher, who said, I notice that impatience arises in you. Probably waiting in the lunch line, I was probably like, come on, take the soup faster, I'm hungry. So impatient, probably saw that, and so in our meeting he said, I noticed impatience. I saw, yeah, impatience, I'm feeling that, I feel that. So, when do you, in your daily life, when do you notice impatience? Like, when do you become impatient? So, well, the grocery store is bad. It's not a good scene. Waiting in line on my way home from work, some groceries, a big line, and I try to pick, okay, who looks like they're fast? Who's the fastest looking person? And I count items in carts, I do my calculation, get in line. I'm wrong. That line's fast. Maybe I'll switch over to that. So the teacher said, okay, interesting. So what I want you to do for the next month is every day on your way home from work, I want you to grab one item in the grocery store and stand in the longest line. And I want you to tune into the sensations in your body. Just be with what's arising. So I did what he said, and I watched in patience. I felt all the constrictions and the tightness and tinglings and... and so on. And he said, if you get to the cashier and you're still feeling things, yeah, get out of the line. So I actually had to tell the manager of that store. I think at one point he was going to call the police or something. Got this weird person who just keeps getting into line with a can of beans. And then when he's finished, he actually puts the can of beans back on the shelf and goes home. But I really got to know impatience. And so it was more than a month, because I went back and I said, some patience is still... So go in there. So I think I went through three months of observing impatience. I really got to know impatience so that, familiar with it. So when as soon as a little tinge of impatience arises, there's impatience. There it is. It's kind of loses its juice after you've sat around, you've been with it that much, and it's just an arising. It didn't grab me. I didn't start the thought processes that fuel it. Why? Because I did. It experienced enough of the suffering that it was causing. So it was a question like, why? Why bother? Why bother fueling this and continuing it? And we can do that with any strong emotional. We can do anger. Just pick whatever, like notice what's creating suffering, what emotional arises in you and creates suffering. And then just be with it. Be with it. Really get to know it, and start with the body. So I think that's why the body is so important. So that covered that one. grief. The death of a loved one.
Yeah.
So grief is not inconsistent with the Four Noble Truths. So just like other emotions, we allow it. It's not suppressing it. Just allowing, just being, putting out the welcome mat, and allowing grief to just be the sadness that comes with it, and so on. Yeah, I don't know what else I can say. I mean, I think there's through the stages of grief. Yeah, be with all the aspects of the Buddha. There's stories of the experiencing sadness and grief. It's part of the human experience. It's part of that dukkha that arises, losing loved ones. Now, depending on the level of attachment, the loss of a loved one can be have different impacts. So that's part of attachment, is not realizing that everyone dies. We become attached and become surprised when somebody dies. That's the nature of human existence. Not to be morbid about it or cold, but it's the reality of being, of existence, is birth and death. And we celebrate birth, and we can also celebrate death. And realizing our own death. That we know we will die, we just don't know when. Being accepting that. Many of our fears are, underneath it all, is a fear of death. Much of the not wanting things the way they are, you dig down deep enough, there's a fear of death, not accepting that we will die. The Buddha had so many death practices. Again, not something we do in the West, contemplate death. And he wasn't trying to be depressing or morbid. It was just to point out the reality of human existence, not to sort of bury our heads in the sand around death. Notice how we suffer when we're attached. And this can be death, or it can be a relationship if we're attached. Be attached to our partners. Could be more attached. The degree to which we're attached, there's a formula. Sayadaw Tanjaniya has a formula of suffering. I hope I get it. The degree to which you're detached equals the amount of suffering you experience when that ceases. So I really look at this, my wife, we're very close. There's a certain element of degree of attachment. I have to realize she could die any day before me. She could leave me for somebody else. Nothing's guaranteed. I think that's probably why I was so joyous when she started practicing and getting involved in the Dharma, because I thought, she could meet some guy like with a real job. Yeah, not some guy that comes home with envelopes with, see what I got today, dear. But there was, I saw that. I saw that Emma. There's just no guarantee here. So I think that's why there's joy. She's involved in the Dharma, and there's a closeness and a sharing that's happening. That's quite beautiful. So that I get attached to that. You know? So it's being equanimous, a sense of equanimity with what is. And that was another question. What is equanimity? Equanimity is, it's a lot what we're talking about, being okay with what is. So it's kind of the springboard to enlightenment, you could say. Because you can be, there can be equanimity, but not enlightenment. So there's still an I that is equanimous. The I am okay with whatever arises. So there's still an I present. With enlightenment, there's no buddy home. There's no I that this is happening to. Things are simply arising and unfolding. It's just life unfolding. But the sense of equanimity, it's one of the seven factors of enlightenment. It's one of the four divine abodes or Brahma Viharas, with loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy. Upekkha, to it actually translates to look. So to be able to just see, just seeing, not and within that, the seeing is enough. Right? And that's what we do in our practice. The seeing is the doing. We're simply seeing what's already arisen. I'm getting through these questions kind of quickly. That's pretty good. of course, I haven't talked much about the Four Noble Truths, but I did, or the Eightfold Path, but I did tell you what they were. Oh, the difference between non-meditation and choiceless awareness speaks to what I just said, and what is absolute enlightenment. So in choiceless awareness, there's still the presence of an observer, right? You're observing. There's an observer being choicelessly aware. So whatever arises into awareness, you're seeing it. In nod meditation, you let go of the observer. So there's no witnessing or observing what comes into awareness. There's just simply being. Yeah. I can't say a whole lot more other than that without using a lot of confusing words. Lama Suridas, who some of you might have heard, I did a actually that was my last retreat. I was trying to remember what my last retreat was. I was with Lama Suridas. And he at the Garrison Institute, he begins with non-meditation. So the Dogen folks call there's the fast track to enlightenment. He says that to everything he says, not everything, but a good 20% of what he says is his tongue is firmly in his cheek. But so he does call it the fast track to enlightenment. He's got that book out called Make Me One with Everything. That's his latest book. And it comes from the joke. He's a New Yorker. He's a funny guy. Goes up to a hot dog stand and says, "Make me one with everything." The guy makes him the hot dog, and the guy gives him $5. He gives him the hot dog. He goes, "What about my change?" He goes, "Change comes from within." So that's the kind of sense of humor he has, right? So he named his book "Make Me One with Everything" based on that joke. If you want to see a really funny YouTube video, actually, if you friend me on Facebook, it's one of my late. I just posted this video recently. an interviewer interviewing the Dalai Lama, and like a newscaster type guy. I don't know who it is. And anyway, the clip is of him telling this joke to the Dalai Lama. He says pizza. He goes, have you ever heard the joke about the guy who walks up into the pizza parlor and says, make me one with everything? And the translator starts talking, and the Dalai Lama says, pizza. And then he just kind of looks, make me one with everything? Pizza? And he's just like... just like totally flopped. The translator's yakking away and the Dalai Lama never cracks a smile. And the interviewer's laughing his head off at his own joke and the Dalai Lama's still not laughing. Oh, it's cute. It's very funny. How did I get onto that? So non-meditation. It's a dojen begins just resting and being. So even saying resting means, oh, there's somebody resting. So there's not even that. It's one way to look at it is right understanding is understanding dukkha, understanding suffering, understanding impermanence, that all things are shifting. And nothing's permanent. Like everything, never mind nothing. Everything is different from one moment to the next. It's different than saying nothing's permanent. Everything is different, one moment to the very next moment. And then selflessness, the selfless nature of what's arising. It's based on causes and conditions, with no self in control of or behind what's arising. It's just life unfolding. So those are the, you know, the wise understanding is understanding and having some direct experience of those three marks of existence. So that's kind of, once you've had a taste, you don't, it doesn't even have to be like knowing that you know, in that sense of, you know, kind of burnt into your knowing it deeply in your bones, but even just having a taste, that moment when we've all had these tastes of truth, that's non-meditation. That just allowing that to be your experience of meditation. So my last kind of taste of wise understanding was when I'd come back from a long retreat, and a very still and silent retreat, and I was walking Rocky, my little Esky poo, half poodle, half American Eskimo, cute little guy, and he poops like he always does, and you know, I put the bag, biodegradable bag, on my hand, and I'm reaching down to pick up the poo, and I had a moment of opening. And my mind, I can surmise, and of course the mind jumps in with analysis, that I surmise that that's a fairly point of concentration, right? Like, you don't want to get your hand in the poo. So I was fairly focused. And I wasn't thinking about, you know, this or the past or the future. I was in the moment with that pile of poo in my hand in the bag. And what it allowed was an opening. And so that taste is sort of what one can and then bring into non-meditation. The taste of freedom. And it tends to happen. It's those kind. You'd sit for, you know, sit and strive for that sense, and it'll be elusive. And it comes when the mind is relaxed and open. So of course, in my mind, well, I'll just poo, Rocky, poo. I want another one. Uh, The mind jumps in, right? And it also jumps in to try and analyze what just happened. And so it's just allowing all that to just, you know, just be. So that's the non-meditation. You got more than you bargained for on that question. Yeah. Equanimity. Okay. I don't know that I'll talk about right speech, right action, and right livelihood. They're very important. We incline our lives towards non-harming with those. Right effort is an important one. It's interesting that it's in the Eightfold Path. The two that probably right livelihood. You only have eight things. The livelihood is in there. I find interesting, that we align, and it's not so much the job, but the way we do the job in a way that's non-harming. My our daughter is an environmental biologist. You could call her an environmentalist, I guess. Got her master's and is really like all about birds and conservation and so on. So she graduates and wants to get a job in her field. Gets a job in Fort McMurray. So she was torn. She's going, here I'm living in a Suncor camp and working for a company that I don't agree, her ethics didn't connect with what they're doing to the environment. So I said, well, it's up to you, but I talked to her about right livelihood in so many words. It's how you do this job and what you bring to the job, and get some experience so you can get it. There's the practical dad that kicks in. So she was protecting birds, right? It wasn't her job to protest the tar sands. Her job was to protect birds in that context. So she managed to do the job, and the way she did it was to be genuine to what her ethics were. and then really learned a lot about how things are, and actually would run around telling people not to invest in, don't buy stock in this company or this company. So she actually was able to provide, to do some activism kind of, because she's got knowledge now, right? She's lived in the camp. She knows how they operate. So that's a bit I could say about right livelihood. So how you do the job. So right effort. Wise effort. So which is better, a mind that is quiet or a mind that is noisy? What do you think? What's better? It's a trick question. This points to wise effort, because it's just what's arising, right? And so we're being with, whether it's noisy mind or quiet mind, it's just what's arising. So we're not expecting anything from our practice. So as soon as we start to expect certain things to happen from our practice, there's striving. There's willful effort, you could call it. So there's an I that wants something. I call that willful effort, as opposed to wise effort. wise effort is putting energy into something that's important. There's an aspiration for truth, aspiration. And trusting in the practice. So often meditators use willful effort. There's an I that's wanting to attain particular things. So it's just to recognize that. And that when you notice that, that's what's there. That it's a willful effort. So wise effort's kind of an easy effort. There's not a straining or a contracting. And there's no expectation of anything from practice. That's a hard one to hear, to absorb, and to no expectation of anything from practice. I'm getting some puzzled looks, but perhaps you have expectations. If you can come with that sense, it comes with trust. So at first you hear some of the teachings and you kind of go, might make sense. So you try it out. Oh yeah, it's true. That's the Buddha guy was right in this case. And then you hear something else. Ooh, that one sounds sketchy. But, yeah, I'll try it. Like self, when I first heard the three care, I thought, yeah, I can see dukkha and I can see impermanence. But I think he got the third one wrong, because I really feel like there's a self here. Like, there's definitely, I'm in control, and there's a self, and like body, got all these opinions. So I really thought he got the third one wrong. But, you know, 2 out of 3 is not bad. I'll read some more. you kind of test the teaching, and you go, oh, geez, that resonates too. I find that's true in my direct experience. And after a while, you've seen this enough times, you'd start to trust in the teachings. You start to trust in the practice, and that's when you can just allow. You hear the teachings, and you just trust. You don't expect. And that's a real turning point in our practice, where there's a trust rather than an expectation of something. Like, why should I do that again? What do I get out of it? Is the wanting something out of it, as opposed to, oh, this is the practice. Oh, let me try that and see what happens. Let's practice it and see what happens. So the don't know mind, just engage in the practice. I don't know what's going to happen. You don't know anyway, right? Even if you think you do. So you're making effort. So there's purposefulness, but you're also surrendering to whatever arises, to whatever happens. So there's this balance between effort and surrender. That's crucial. So that there can be a natural unfolding of experience. And when getting this paradox is often a turning point in people's practice, I find in the West. Understanding that balance between effort and surrender. So you're practicing like your hair's on fire, as the Buddha said, so there's an immediacy to it. There's also a surrender to it. So then noticing when willful effort arises, there's when there's self-improvement, there's a sense of self. When there's a sense of wanting gain, like self-improvement, then we usually end up, we see the limitations of willful effort, and we start to become perhaps a little gentler in our effort. You could call that gentle effort. So it's self-efforting, but with a kind of the edges smoothed off a bit. Begin to just notice and observe what's arising. The gentle curiosity, and then wise effort arises based on wise view and wise understanding. We see the emptiness of self, and we begin to ask the tough questions that threatens the sense of self. The egoic mind hangs on tenaciously. It's amazing. And it's because we're wired that way, right? We're wired to approach pleasant and push away unpleasant. We're wired to try and stabilize situations. And these are, you know, things that have got us evolutionary-wise. Rick Hansen talks a lot about this in his books. But it's allowed the species to survive, but it also is what causes us to suffer, this kind of unease, and dissatisfaction, or dukkha. So it's just seeing that, and it's not a problem. It's just the way it is. It's the way we're wired. So we're really kind of rewiring, in a sense, through our practice. I meant to read this poem when we were talking about being with grief and being with emotions that are intense. It's the name of the, so it's Naomi Shihab Nye, and the name of the poem is Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread, only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it until your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. This is only the only kindness that makes sense anymore. Let's just sit for a moment.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.